Hello, it's Dana Gould. Yes, Gex himself. And you're listening to the Pop Zara podcast. Why? Because it's tale time.
Welcome to the Pop Zara podcast. If you like what you hear, why not leave us a review or rating? Not only do we appreciate the feedback, but it helps our ranking and expands our audience. Every little bit helps.
Welcome back to another episode of the Pop Zara podcast. This is your host, Nathan Evans, the managing editor of PopZara.com, and here with another episode that's guaranteed to drive you bananas. And our guest today is acclaimed writer slash comedian slash voice actor slash producer, whose credits include years working with Ben Stiller, hence all the slashes, appearing everywhere from episodes of Seinfeld to Mad TV, and even writing for a little show called The Simpsons. He's currently producing and occasionally guest starring in the hit horror comedy Stand Against Evil, starring the irrepressible John C. McGinley. Ladies and gentlemen, after that long intro, please welcome comedian Dana Gould to the podcast. Dana.
Indeed. Hi, yeah. More slashes than a Friday the 13th sequel.
You see, we get to the point now where you got to tell people the joke because they don't know the references anymore.
I know.
And I'm so sorry. You know, and whatever goodwill, you know, Zoolander had, well, we don't talk about the sequel. But anyway, moving forward, I just want to say, how do you feel that Stand Against Evil is still on and Ash versus Evil Dead is not?
Well, I love them both. I'm big fans of them both. I love Bruce. I never thought of the shows as that similar, which is weird. Only shows as similar as those two could be thought of as not similar by someone so aside. If I thought they were, because to me, I'm such a horror fan that I would think, well, no, that's gore based humor, and this is dialogue based humor. They're completely different.
It's like trying to tell people what the difference between Star Wars and Star Trek is. Like, no, one's fantasy and one's sci-fi. They're totally different.
That's a perfect example. To the point that I even, you know, if I had thought people would perceive them as being similar, I wouldn't have named it I would have called it Willard's Mill or just something completely different. I hope everybody on the, you know, is, you get to the point where I hope they're all working.
Bruce is going to be fine. Hey. The USA Today Network always needs him. He's always there.
Yeah.
But no,
hey,
I was going to say...
Hey, Gene, I did a movie with Bruce Campbell.
Who hasn't? I haven't done my movie yet, but I'm going to... At some point, we're going to get him on this one, and we're going to have a good time.
I felt like I had arrived.
You know, I was going to say, first of all, I want to thank you for showing up, because you are actually the second person from the Simpsons family that's been on this podcast. We had Mike Reese on a couple weeks ago, and we had a lot
that's
of fun.
Right.
Yeah, he was talking about his new book, Springfield Confidential. We had a lot of fun. And I want to say something. He and I were joking both on and off about our mutual love for the show he worked on, ALF. And immediately, like, boom, right after he was on the show, they announced that ALF was going to be rebooted.
Of course it is.
Of course, because why not? But
is it going to be CG ALF now, or...?
I'll be honest with you, it has to be a puppet because they tried that CG stuff with Kermit and the Muppets. Don't work. But
work. They're part of it. Yeah, no, I understand that. We have an evil puppet episode of Stand Against Evil this year, and you know, the whole point of it is that it's puppets. There's a folk art aspect to it. I was explaining to some people, like, they don't look that scary. No, that's the point. you need to see the strings and tell that it's felt. That's why that's the whole point.
I like the new Muppet movies, the Disney ones. I like them, but I squinched whenever I saw that they use CG to add legs and remove the strings. It doesn't I don't need to be convinced that these aren't Muppets. We know they're Muppets.
Yeah. Seeing the strings is part of it. Seeing the strings is and the rods.
It's crazy. You know, I know Brian Henson has that new movie coming out with Melissa McCarthy. I think it's coming out this week or next week. I don't know about that. We'll have to see how that plays out with R-rated. I know Peter Jackson's probably very jealous because I think he did it first. But
yeah, he did.
But as long as ALF has Paul Fusco, I'm okay on some level.
Uh-huh. ALF was for a while my dad's favorite show. My dad loved ALF.
I will not I will not couch anybody telling me that ALF was not a good show. I don't care what the naysayers say. That and Night Court are two of my favorite shows of the 80s. I will take that to my grave. But no, I don't really want to talk about remakes of shows. I want to talk about Planet of the Apes.
That's right.
You're here for it. Not a remake.
Something that has never been remade or had sequels.
Well, I want to say, you know, you've got a pretty good career that you've involved. You've got voice acting, you've got acting, you've got voice acting and acting, and you have the weird distinction of being one of the only people on to appear on Family Guy, not as a voice actor, but as yourself.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, certainly one of the only Simpsons employees to appear on Family Guy, yes.
And you came out alive. No, but for those who aren't those haven't tuned out, we're talking about an upcoming graphic novel called Planet of the Apes Visionaries, which attempts to take the legendary Rod Serling's unused script for the that was supposed to be the original movie, the 1968 movie Planet of the Apes. And Dana, along with artist Chad Lewis, has gone back heroically, I might add, and drawn the thing and made it available.
And so, yeah, Chad drew it completely. I adapted it. And he did an amazing job. What we wanted to do, this was the first draft of the screenplay that Rod Serling did. He was the first writer on the project, and he took Pierre Boulle's book and turned it into a movie, which is no small feat. You know, that the original novel is it's a lot like Gulliver's Travels. It's a satirical story. It's not an action adventure sci-fi epic, and he sort of put it into a story form. Like, he really, as they say, that terrible expression, broke its back, and made it a three act structured story. But like the novel, it takes place, it's strictly very satirical. It takes place in a modern day city. It's there's a lot of bureaucratic intrigue. It's very much a political thriller and a satire. It's not the movie that you know of when you think of Planet of the Apes. It actually felt a lot like 7 Days in May, which was also written by Rod Serling. Once you get into the second act, the first act is very similar.
So I was going to I was going to ask you real quick. So you mentioned the original author, Pierre Boulle, who original story, which, by the way, is fantastic. If you haven't read it, please go out and seek the translation. If you can't read French, it's called La Planète de la Singe, I think. What's interesting, Dana, is that it actually translates into Planet of the Monkeys. And my question is, do you think they changed the name because people would have been confused? They would have thought, hey, we're going to see a movie about a planet of like Mickey Dolenz's and Davy Jones.
Very, very true. I think the book was published in English before the movie. I believe, I don't know. And you think I would know that. and it was Planet of the Apes. I think it was probably just a better title, but the only thing that dates the movie is Lucius, the hippie ape, who might as well be played by Mickey Dolenz.
I was going to say, the only thing missing is like the beanie. But
yeah.
But you know,
hey,
it's funny.
Man, always always giving orders, just like ever the Delts, man. Yeah, it's the hippie ape is the only thing that places it in the late 60s.
That's the only thing, not anything else. No. I was going to say, so getting a chance to read your adaptation of Rob Serling, first of all, thank you very much, because it gave me an excuse to go back and relive my ape fetish. And by the way, I mean that in a good way.
I hope.
I understand, like, I found earlier this year that Bigfoot erotica was trending on Twitter, so I got to be very careful what I say. I don't want to go viral. But
every time I hear that, I just think, what a wonderful world.
What a world we live in. What a world we live in where, you know, we have a president who may be indicted, but we're worried about Bigfoot erotica.
Exactly.
So our priorities are exactly where they need to be.
Exactly. But, exactly. We are who we deserve to be.
So I want to get back to this, though, because you've adapted in graphic novels. And for those who don't follow it religiously, graphic novels, whatever you want to call it, sequential art if you're pretentious. But
okay, nice.
The fact is that they've come into their own recently, where you have creators able to do things that Hollywood would never take a chance on, because Lord knows, you know,
you know,
Lord knows an industry that made three, you know, super babies movies would never take a chance. But So if you've read the original story, you understand the framing of the story would never work in any other medium except for literature, because I hate to, you know, spoilers for a 50-year-old story, but you know, they have that M. Night Shyamalan type of twist,
right,
where you find out, yeah, the narrators are actually apes. That would never work in a graphic novel because you'd reveal it. You know, it would never,
yeah,
work,
exactly,
in a movie to reveal it. So
exactly. So
we talk about remaking Planet of the Apes, but we're not really remaking it though, right? We're sort of just reimagining it, so to speak.
Yeah, unlike the, you know, unlike the Tim Burton version of reimagining Planet of the Apes, what this is it's really a very interesting way to look at how movies are made. This is the first draft of this story, and it's a different story, and it's a different kind of movie. The main character is not named Taylor, he's named Thomas, and he's a different type of character than Taylor. Taylor is a very sarcastic, misanthropic pain in the ass, and Thomas is a very traditional, you know, it's a giant episode of the Twilight Zone, and he's a very typical Twilight Zone hero. He's a stand-in for Rod Serling, a nice, well-dressed, mid-century urban liberal, and he reacts differently than Taylor did. So it's interesting how just changing the personality of the lead character changes the movie,
uh-huh,
and changes the story. So you really get to see this story told in a different way. And that was what really surprised me as I did it, as I went through it, was it's the same premise, but a very, very different way to tell the story. It's a very different way to tell the story.
You know, it's funny because when you needed a Superman to front your 1960s, early 70s sci-fi blockbuster, you got Charlton Heston.
Right.
And that's sort of a role that would be filled 20 years later by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes.
And what's funny is that you're in Hollywood, so you know this. Whenever people talk about remaking an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, which they've attempted many times, the remakes always flop, and they say, how come we have a better actor? Well, but you don't have Arnold. You know, you,
yeah,
need that charisma. And I agree with you. I appreciate how in the graphic novel you sort of reverted the main character away from the Charlton Heston, you know, gruffy, and you've made him a lot more of a scientist.
Yeah, well, that's who. I mean, the original choice for him in 65, 66, when they first started talking about this, was Paul Newman,
uh-huh,
and he's very much a Paul Newman stand-in. He's a very, you know, reasonable, rational guy. I mean, I used to joke, Taylor is an asshole.
Yeah,
he's. Spends the entire first 20 minutes of the movie torturing one of the other astronauts. It's like, you're in charge of morale, buddy. It's your mission. It would be like, as if on Star Trek, they were surrounded by Klingons and Kirk just said, they're good, we deserve to die. You know, it's like, no.
Yeah, nobody wants that. Yeah,
you're in charge of morale.
The movie, you need that buoyancy. You know, if they were to make a new movie based on your graphic novel, I would picture someone more like Richard Chamberlain, you know, beard and all, like 1970s,
yeah,
Richard Chamberlain, someone a lot more subdued, you know, not the plastic surgery Richard Chamberlain that exists now, but, you know.
Right, yeah, no, it would be, if you were to make this movie,
mm-hmm,
if you were to make this script as a movie, it would be George Clooney. It would be like a reasonable, intelligent guy.
Yeah, someone who wouldn't, because I was talking to my producer, Chris, before the show, and we were talking about the classic line in the movie, you know, get your paws off me, you damn dirty,
yeah,
ape. And he, like everybody else, myself, I've seen the movie a million times, and even I forget that he doesn't say paw, he doesn't say hands, he says paws.
Yeah.
And he was, and Chris brought it up, that gives the line even more weight because he's personalizing it to the apes. He's not saying hands, he's saying paws, like,
yeah,
you're a dirty animal.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there is that sort of reveal in the graphic novel. But
and now, the other interesting thing, the really brilliant thing about Charlton Heston's portrayal in that film is that he's a misanthrope. He hates humanity, and he ends up being the only person defending it. And that's a great twist, and that's a very fascinating, clever
That's a very Sterling thing, though. That's something that Rod Sterling would have done, you know. And so I want to get into it real quick. We can't avoid it. Let's talk about the Twilight Zone for a second. So now in the book, in the notes, you talk about your love for Twilight Zone. So I just want to say thumbs up. And oh my goodness, what's his name?
Planet of the Apes is just the biggest episode of the Twilight Zone they ever made. It's the same structure. It's the same, you know. It's just a big, beautiful Twilight Zone episode.
I was going to say, if Jordan Peele, if you're listening, because I know he's planning to remake Twilight Zone, stay to that. Don't try to update it like the 80s. Don't try to update it like the 90s. Stay to that angst and that sort of, you know, melodrama, because that's what made it fun. So, but really quick, so let's talk about Twilight Zone. So Rod Sterling created one, in my opinion, perhaps the greatest anthology show of all time. The only thing that comes close, in my opinion, is either the Alfred Hitchcock Presents or Tales from the Crypt. So another show they're going to try to remake. Please don't do that.
Or Misfits and Monsters, if you
You know what? Remake something that no one's heard of, and that way if you screw it up, no one cares. But you know, don't put Besiege. But going back, though, so a lot of people have talked about how, like you said, when Rod Sterling made the script for Planet of the Apes, he essentially just stitched together a lot of ideas from the Twilight Zone. Did you notice that when you were going back through his script?
Yeah, I think there are. Well, he as a writer has a personality and he has his opinions, and they find their way into whatever you do. I find that whatever I write, it ends up being about my father somehow, or, you know, that weird relationship. And those things find their way into your work. And Rod Sterling was a very moral guy. He was very politically active, and he was a very committed humanitarian. And those theories, you know, that attitude and that perspective is going to find its way into the work. It's unavoidable.
So, you know, so when you go back and you look at we're talking about a time period of which, you know, the existential threat, so to speak, of the Cold War, and people, kids were ducking under their seats, and political assassinations. I mean, for those who don't know, and I want to get into this, get your opinions just in a second, Planet of the Apes in America came out the day before Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated.
Yes.
You know, and there have been a lot of, you know, postscript analysis of the original film for its you know, racial progressiveness, so to speak, including from Charlton Heston. So my question is, for those who don't know, who haven't read the original story, who may not even seen the original movie, how do you think modern audiences would look at your version, your sort of reinterpretation of Rod Sterling's script for today's audiences from that perspective?
It was, you know, it's one of those things where it was very progressive for its time. You know, in the original book, everybody's white. But the ape society is very classist, like a European culture is. You know, it was written in France, and it was, you know, written about French culture at the time. So it's very class oriented. The strange thing about the movie, the other thing that dates the movie, though not to any specific time, is the incredibly archaic view of women. There's a line in the movie, in the final movie, where he says, you know, "Did I tell you about Stuart? There was a lovely girl, the most precious cargo we brought along. She was to be the new Eve." It's like, one, cargo. Two, did she know she was to be the new Eve? I bet she thought she was the botanist.
I was going to say, we're gonna spring that on you later.
Yeah. Well, let's crack the seal on Operation New Eve and see what that's about. Wink, wink. And when you watch it now, I saw it recently at a theater with a bunch of people, and those lines do get laughs of disbelief. But the story itself, and certainly the Sterling version, it's heart's very much in the right place. The Nova character is not very prevalent in the Serling movie. Doesn't really waste a lot of time with her.
I was going to say, because in the original Pierre version, Nova is, let's just say it, is pure sex. That's what she's there for. She's sex. She's sex, sex, sex. And she's eventually used as a sort of a pawn to help the main character. And she becomes domesticated. But in the movie version, played by Linda Harrison, she's still sex, but she's not as pivotal. And I noticed in the graphic novel, Serling she's less pivotal, and she's much less sex. There's a scene in your book where she's actually become literally domesticated.
Yeah.
You know, which trained.
Yeah. And that's a good way to put it. And it's, that was a vestige of the Boole novel. And that was one of the things that was interesting about this book. In the Boole novel, humanity fell from its preeminence atop the food chain simply because it stopped using its brain. It was like its brain atrophied because we stopped using them, basically. To that end, it's a very – there's no science to it at all. There's no simian flu. There's no nuclear war. It's just man gave up, and so apes took over because we stopped trying. And what is a vestige in this movie, I call it a movie, it's a graphic novel, but what happens is, Thomas sort of spends time around these other people and, you know, kicks them around a little bit, they pick up on this long abandoned intellect, and it starts to come to the fore again. It's tricky because you're not in a novel. You're not inside someone's head. You are telling a story. And when you get into, you know, you're physicalizing it, then things do need to be, they need a reason to happen. And it's not just a satirical novella.
Sure.
And that was a tricky thing to make work. I have a feeling over the course of the development of the script that might have gone away. It certainly did in the Michael Wilson version. But that's the beauty of bringing to life a first draft, is it's a raw retelling of the story. It's a new and interesting telling of the story.
You know, that whole concept that's very, very clear in all the versions of Planet of the Apes, with the exception maybe of the Tim Burton one, because I don't know what the hell was going on there. But
you're not alone.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I mean, I want to go back to that before we exit, because I do have some laudatory things to say about it, like with the costumes. But the whole central thesis is the whole, you know, the classic Galileo Galilei and, you know, the heliocentrism where, you know, you're telling me that man could think, aka you're telling me that the Earth is not the center of the universe. And we're going to convince you by any means necessary. It is. So, you know, Orwell talked about it in 1984. How many fingers do you see? You know, do you want to live or do you want to be lobotomized and turn into a taxidermied stuffing?
Right.
You know, but that's present in all of them.
I think you mean Rudy Giuliani said that, I think.
Really? It's like I was talking to my friend the other day, and so much of modern history is just repeating itself, and we're getting closer. We're closing that gap where I can listen to Game of Thrones, and I can hear like Barry Goldwater speeches. Like, you know what? I've watched way too much TV. Click. You know, we're not political. We don't put presidents' heads on spikes. That's not us. We're better than that. But we've always done that. It's everyone thinks that their generation does something new. No, it's all repeating. And speaking of repeating, though, I want to go back to your graphic novel again. We talked about rebooting and how this is not a reboot, but a retelling. Isn't it funny, Dana, how Planet of the Apes, if we're going to just start off, let's start off in 1968, how this movie has survived every attempt to remake it, to expand it, to change it. For some reason, the original movie always bounces back, and it's still the de facto version. And my question to you is, and
it's a perfect movie, and
yes.
By that I don't mean it's the greatest movie of all time, but it's a perfect movie. There's not a bad frame in it, and it's just serious enough. You know, it's not. It is the movie, because of the budget, they couldn't film it in a modern city. So they set it in Bedrock. It's so funny they talk about, well, we saw these Gaudi cliff dwellings. Yeah, you also could have watched the Flintstones. It's the same thing. what's amazing is because of that, it became an action adventure movie that was just serious enough. And that's what's amazing about it to me.
But it's funny because I think when you get to be a certain age, I don't know, you're a little older than I am, but when you grow up, I'm 110 in cat years. But yeah, exactly. But the fact is, you know, you have to. It's like when you see the AFI list of greatest movies, it's always a fight for Vertigo and Citizen Kane. And I got to tell you something, I have never met anybody under the age of 30 who's ever seen those movies, but I've met dozens of people who've seen Planet of the Apes. Because sure. At the end of the day, Planet of the Apes is a movie you want to watch. It's not a movie you have to be told to watch. And I think sometimes with certain types of films, elitists, they don't like that. They don't like the idea that their recommendations are being taken as gospel.
Well, it's not a film; it's a movie. That right out of the gate, you have a problem. It's a movie. It's a movie.
It's actually fun. And it makes you think.
Fun. Yeah, I mean, I saw it when I was, you know, whatever, a 9. And it blew my – I saw it when it – I didn't see it until it came on TV in 1973, and I was 9 years old. And it blew me away. I certainly didn't see Vertigo at 9.
Hey, kids, let's go watch. Do you remember that episode of Mad Men where Draper takes his daughter?
Yeah, of course.
And they're enjoying it. You know, they're just enjoying this movie. It's a generational thing, but
Ape News, which was a real thing.
You know what's funny? I don't know. Have you ever heard of the book? It was a book, goodness, it's like 50 years old. It's called The Studio by an author, John Gregory Dunn. And yeah, sure. You read it? Yeah. And there's
Griffin Dunn's related, I believe Griffin Dunn's uncle, I think.
It's well, for those who don't know, it's this fascinating look where the writer was let into 20th Century Fox while they were while they were preparing and making two big movies. One of them was Dr. Doolittle, and the other one was Planet of the Apes.
Oh, right.
And the consensus was that Dr. Doolittle was going to be their prestige picture. It was going to be the one that saved the studio. It was going to be the one that supplaced. I forget. You have to forgive me. I'm getting my 60s musicals messed up.
Well, Hello, Dolly. Fox. In the early 60s, Fox made Cleopatra, which at the time Cleopatra was the biggest box office hit of 1963, and it still lost money. Uh-huh. It bankrupted the studio. The reason you have Conquest of the Planet of the Apes is because they had to sell their backlot to realtors, and they built the Century City Mall, and that's where they shot Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. But the old joke in Hollywood, Cleopatra was written and directed by Joseph Mankiewicz. And the old joke in Hollywood used to be, there's the mall Joseph Mankiewicz built, because Fox had to sell off their back lot to stay open. And then after Cleopatra, then they fell into that other trap again with Dr. Doolittle and Hello, Dolly. They were a terrible time, and it was very indicative of where major studios were in the mid to late 60s when the Easy Rider revolution was coming about, and they didn't know what people wanted to see or why, and they were really shooting in the dark.
Tell you what, though, they wanted to see apes.
They did want to see apes. It was a huge hit.
They made 5 of them, and I was talking to somebody just today. You know, this was all the apes films came before Star Wars. And I don't know if you've ever seen that great documentary series on Netflix. We've had him on this program too. Forgive me, the name escapes me. If you're listening, we love you. The series was The Toys That Made Us, and they talked about the genesis. Yeah, we talked about the genesis of toys like Star Wars and Star Trek, and they came from Planet of the Apes, unused Planet of the Apes toys. You know, so it's really interesting to see what life was like in pop culture before.
I do know that George Lucas took Star Wars to Fox because they had Planet of the Apes, and he felt that they would understand it.
So If we're going back to 2018 real quick, so Planet of the Apes Visionaries, your graphic novel, clearly it's time to coincide with the 50th anniversary of all things apes, and so congratulations.
Yep.
And the cover of the book, and I don't have the artist's name on me, but the cover in your notes, the artist who he actually says, you know, where'd you get the cover from? He's like, oh, from the movie, the Charlton Heston movie.
Right.
Of course, it's iconic.
Oh, I should know it, and I apologize. I'm going to find it right now.
I don't even know my mother's name, so it you know. If you send me a check, I'll remember who you are.
Yeah, but I'm not professional. I should know this. Give me a minute, I'll come up.
I could probably name like every ape background actor, but I can't name my own family. But no, we'll get it though. We'll get it. But I'm going through my notes too. So what Dane and I are doing is we're talking to mask the fact we're doing research in the background to make it seem like there's no dead air. So it's a little trick you can't see thanks to podcasting, but if it was TV, we'd be screwed. But going back though, I want to talk about the book real quick though. So book is fantastic. It is exactly what I envisioned when I read the original story. My quick question before we sort of tap this out is I want to go back to one last thing, and that is the genesis of the book, and that is the original test footage, unused test footage. You talk a little bit about this in the thing, and thank you for letting me know this footage was out there. I'd never seen it. I'm a bad apes fan. But so for those who don't know, they filmed some test footage of what the original movie would have been like with Rod Sterling's script, and of course, Edward G. Robinson was going to be Dr. Zaius, right, and James Brolin was going to be Cornelius. With all due respect.
And Linda Harrison is Zira.
Yeah, and so, but I think we traded up. I think Roddy.
Well, that was just for the James Brolin and Linda Harrison were both contract players that were just hired for the for that little test footage. That I don't think that had any bearing on who eventually was in the film. But Edward G. Robinson and Charlton Heston were certainly
were. Yeah. And there's a lot of preliminary artwork, and you and Chad used this artwork as sort of the visual starting point, including the makeup. And I just want to say I'm a huge fan of John Chambers' makeup. I'm a huge fan of John Chambers in general.
Yeah.
And for those who don't know, John Chambers was the man who actually won an Oscar for the makeup in Planet of the Apes, although they couldn't call it best makeup. They had to call it something else because they hadn't quite, you know.
Right.
You know, it's like the Oscars in 2018. You know, they're going to screw it up with the best popular movie. Well,
I don't know what that means. I know I read that and I just scratched my head.
it's a way for Disney to get more Oscars because all their movies will be nominated, because that's all that makes money in Hollywood.
Yeah. Anymore,
Disney movies. But that's fair. It's turnabout's fair play. But I just want to say, so Edward G. Robinson as would have been Dr. Zaius. I love his makeup, and I think it sits aside, and it's fascinating to see that sort of explored in the graphic novel. I don't know what you thought about having, you know,
the first thing I said when we started to talk about, you know, that aspect of the graphic novel was I wanted to show the movie that would have been made had they shot the first draft, and they would have shot the first draft in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted the makeup to look like what the makeup would have been like in 1966, had they gone with the original concept. And the city that they're in is a modern city circa 1966. And the technology that they use and the technology on the spaceship is, you know, based out of the mid-60s. You know, that's, you know, it's their version of the future where you still see reel-to-reel on computer and things like that. It's very much voyage to the bottom of the sea. You know,
yeah, it wasn't Flintstones. It wasn't bedrock.
Right. But it was not a modern day city the way we envision it. It was a modern day city circa 1966. And I wanted the technology that they used to be pinned to that era. And this is your view of what movie would have been made had they made it.
I think that was probably the greatest choice you made. Was locking it into the time that the script was written, because when you read Rod Serling's dialogue, God bless him, he's one of my favorite television writers, but it is very much a product of its time.
That, he was the Aaron Sorkin of his era.
With less F words, F bombs, but and less walking and talking.
He likes speeches.
He likes speeches. And, you know, the scene that's in the test footage, if you compare that scene, which was actually filmed. So we now have an interesting contrast. We actually have the original Serling dialogue from your book. We have the test footage of how it would have been. And we have the movie version. And I must say, with all due respect to you and Serling, I think it worked out for the best. And I think the movie is, it flows, like you said, it's a perfect film. It flows in a way that's very concise for a theatrical film, that's relatable. It is not, it's never held down maudlin. And with a graphic novel, you can sit down, you can enjoy it at your own leisure. You can read dialogue, but with a movie, it needs to have a little more, a little more electricity. And I think it worked out great, but at the same time, I don't think the movie makes your graphic novel, or even Serling's script, obsolete. I think it adds to it. I think you can enjoy these all together more by having this information. And so
yeah, I agree. This is its own thing, and this is really it's two things. One, it's a salute to Rod Serling, who's one of my big heroes. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting look into how movies develop and how they change. You know, there are, you know, it would be an interesting graphic novel, you know, like would be, you know, the first draft of Jaws. You know, Jaws is the movie Jaws is because the shark didn't work. And so they had to
Talk about Bruce the shark, right?
Bruce the shark. You know, there are no barrels in the script. The barrel is all added because the shark didn't work. So they used barrels, and it turned out to be really clever and really great. Necessity is the mother of invention. And I experience that on my show all the time.
You know, if Steven Spielberg had CG back in 1975 or 76, Jaws would have been what the Meg is now. It would just be a big shark.
If they had CG in 75 and 76, Jaws would have been awful.
It wouldn't have had Jason Statham, too. That's the problem. You can forgive a lot of bad CG and a lot of hokiness if you have someone like Charlton Heston or Jason Statham. They're they're, you know, whose charisma distracts you from all the crap. But right. I don't know. I will say
well,
this,
it's
though.
Interesting. It's interesting. They wanted, you know, who wanted to play Brody?
No.
Charlton Heston. Hmm. And they basically said no, because no one will doubt that you're going to kill the shark. You're too larger than life. He needed somebody vulnerable. He needed a real guy, which is, you know, Charlton Heston was a real guy, but he was that iconic Schwarzenegger guy, and he didn't want that. He wanted, no, I need somebody who I think might lose.
Hmm. You know, you're right. It would have been awful. So, no, I think it worked out well, though. I think sometimes history has a way of working out, and when we can look back and see movies like Jaws or Planet of the Apes, you can appreciate them now more than ever, that this sort of miracle of synergy all happened at the same time, and it worked out for the best. And
I agree. I think I 100% agree.
And I will say this before we close it off, because I cannot have you on this podcast without asking you this, because it's perfect. So, for those who don't know, Dana Gould is a longtime writer for The Simpsons. Are you still on the show, by the way?
I'm not on The Simpsons. I'm on my own show.
He's on his own show. But I want to. But I got to go back, because you knew I was going to ask this, because you're a Simpsons. You're part of the Simpsons family. Phil Hartman.
Yeah.
Phil Hartman. Now, I think it might have been before your time, but one of the greatest episodes of that show.
I knew.
You know where I'm going with this. The musical number "Stop the Planet of the Apes." I want to get off.
Yeah.
Thoughts on that?
Well, I wrote a script for the Ben Stiller show, Planet of the Apes, the musical. and then in the second act of that episode, it was a commercial for the musical that was coming to town. And then in the second act, it was Dr. Zaius is Mark Twain tonight. It was Hal Holbrook is Dr. Zaius in Mark Twain tonight. And then the Ben Stiller show got canceled. The Simpsons, before I went to The Simpsons, came up with the idea of Planet of the Apes musical completely on their own. I'm not taking credit for that. They came up with it on their own. I think David Cohen wrote the lyrics, though, the songs. I'm not sure. I wasn't there. They did a much better job than I would have ever done.
Are you equating a Planet of the Apes musical as sort of like a existential inevitability, like the cotton gin, like spontaneous, had to happen?
Yes, that's a perfect example. That's a perfect example. It was an existential inevitability. It was the printing press. It was the cotton gin.
It had to happen.
And I could not, on my best day, have written, I hate every ape I see from chimpanzee to chimpanzee.
You finally made a monkey out of me.
Yeah. I will say that in the sense of the inevitability of Planet of the Apes, the musical, and the cotton gin, Dr. Zayas doing Mark Twain tonight does exist. And it is on YouTube if you search for it.
If you go to Broadway right now, almost every major Broadway thing on this planet literally is a remake of an 80s movie or a 70s movie. I have a feeling that we're at some point the inevitability will become a reality and the joke will become a Tony Award winning musical starring somebody that we probably know. But
very well be. I do know they tried to do a musical of King Kong.
I don't know. They've remade King Kong's another one of those things where everyone tells me it's a great movie, it's the greatest movie, and they remake it. But I don't know anybody who's actually seen the original outside of like Hollywood types. But now Planet of the Apes, people have seen that movie, and I hope they read the book. But before that, I have one final question for you. So, apart from the musical Planet of the Apes, do you have a particularly favorite pop culture riff on the franchise?
What do you mean by pop culture riff on the franchise? And I'll tell you.
See, I'm trying to do like a backwards entry point into Mel Brooks and the movie Spaceballs. I wanted to see if I could get you to lead you to water. So you know what I'm talking about, the end of Spaceballs.
No, I do know what you're talking about. Yes, I'm not only very familiar with that. I'm very familiar with Mr. Brooks and the franchise. The ending of Spaceballs is possibly the best usage of that world, and they shot it on the same beach. They went to Point Doom and shot it on the same beach. Oh shit! Oh hell! There goes the planet.
I always remember the review that Roger Ebert wrote at the time, where he gave Spaceballs a negative review, and he said this movie would have been better had it been made when our interest in Star Wars was still alive. And I thought to myself, I noticed he didn't criticize the relevancy of Planet of the Apes, just the Star Wars part. So,
you know, it's funny. The movie came out in 87, and it was really when Star Wars was kind of like it was the last thing anybody was thinking about. And it's not his critique was not wholly off. What is fascinating about Spaceballs is that it is so beloved because an entire generation of kids saw Spaceballs before Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Little kids saw Spaceballs on VHS and then saw Star Wars when they were older because it was too scary for them when they were little. So that movie, not only has that movie made more money than all of Mel's other films, it is beloved, unlike all of his other films. I mean, which is not to say that his other films aren't beloved, but Spaceballs is above and apart. Of all of that stuff.
It is.
So, Roger Ebert lacked the gift of foresight at the time.
I will tell you one thing, though. Ebert was the rare critic who would go back and reevaluate and re-review and say he was wrong. And I wish more critics would do that today, but that would probably screw up the tomato meter. So, but with that, Dana, I think that's a good place. So I want to say, I want to thank our special guest today, comedian, writer, /a lot of slashes, Dana Gould.
Just, yeah. Dana Gould. Thanks for having me on.
And I got to plug your book. So we got to plug Planet of the Apes, Visionaries. It's out next week from Boom Studios. You can order it on Amazon. Get it. Buy it. Read it on your iPad. Read the paper version. I don't care. It's very good. If you love Planet of the Apes, you're going to love this. Rod Serling's script comes alive. Dana, thank you very much for showing up on the podcast. And best of luck with the future of the apes. And if there is a musical, we called it.
We called it.
I called Alf. Okay, we're going to call it a musical.
Very good.
All right, and with that, thanks everybody for listening to this Pop Zara podcast. We will see everybody next time. Until then, get your paws off me, you damn dirty ape. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Pop Zara podcast. For more quality original content, check out popzara.com for the latest reviews and previews in gaming, movies, tech, and more.